I am delighted to welcome Mike Gerbus as our guest. Mike is the CEO of a constellation of organizations, and they all share a common purpose: to achieve a sustainable, prosperous, and socially just future in one generation.
One generation, yeah.
What's the role of leadership in driving more sustainable practices across all types of organizations?
So leadership plays a critical role in a number of aspects with regards to sustainability. First, we need to move fast. So the climate crisis is a critical issue. It's something we have to move within a generation, and that requires leadership at all levels. So leadership occurs not only from top down, but as a grassroots movement. And so leadership plays a fundamental role in changing our behaviors and changing the direction in which the company goes, the corporation goes, the community goes, or our country goes. And we've seen that on the political level on a number of countries, right? So we need to turn the ship, and leadership is fundamental to that moving forward, that progress.
What are the characteristics of leadership that you believe are required? Because this is a big lift.
Yeah, absolutely. Leadership requires risk-taking. Uh-huh. It takes patience. It takes very good listening and communication skills. Or communication skills in that you need to be able to articulate your vision and where you want to go. Uh-huh. But more importantly, you need to listen. Listen to other perspectives in that. And you really have to be authentic nowadays. Really connecting with people and being true to what you're trying to push forward and understanding where these individuals are that you're trying to lead.
What brought you to focus your career, and I'm guessing your life, on this?
So it's funny, I actually was a typical student that I didn't know what I wanted to be or what I wanted to do. And I took a course back in university that really intrigued me in the sustainability and environment side. When I took my master's degree, I managed to hook up with a very interesting professor who focused on change management. And from there, I started my own business right out of school, focusing on waste reduction in small, medium-sized businesses.
And then where did you go from that?
From there, I spent about 3 years doing that. I then went traveling for a while. Again, part of development and leadership is understanding those different perspectives. And I found that travel around the world allowed me to gain a number of perspectives that I'd never thought about. And then came back, started the company up again that I was running, joined Delphi in 2007.
What is Delphi?
So Delphi is a strategic consulting firm. We've been around since 1988, and we were a leader even when we were only three individuals because we greened the Canadian Pacific hotels. So, of course, if you go into any hotel now around the world, you'll see programs that ask you to hang up your towels or put a card on the bed. And we started that when we were only three individuals in the company.
And now almost every hotel I go into has a program like that.
That's right. Yeah. So this is a great example of where I always tell students that even if you're small, you can have a huge impact within and with outside your sphere of influence. That's what I call your area that you can impact, in your leadership.
Now, what is Shad Valley International?
So Shad Valley is a not-for-profit that brings together students for a month of concentrated education over the summer at various universities across Canada. And they bring these individuals together and they do projects and team building, different challenges and so forth. So it's a real bonding opportunity, but it's also a huge opportunity for them to understand and learn leadership, the challenges of making something move forward, interpersonal dynamics that you deal with in teams every day.
Do you put them under stress?
They're put under stress themselves because there's so many of them together and it's such an intense month, basically working from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. every day for a month.
And coming together with a group of strangers with that level of intensity does create.
But you quickly learn, as you know, through experience, that people have different perspectives. Mm-hmm. They look at challenges differently. To succeed, you have to figure those dynamics out. There are egos that you have to play with, people who are timid. Again, part of leadership development is understanding humans, right? And what we do and how we operate.
It's certainly part of what I teach.
Yeah.
To work as a team, I need to understand both the personality type and also the motivations.
Absolutely.
What do you care about?
Yeah.
And as a team member, as soon as I understand what you care about, then we can support one another's success.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think just building on that, I think you also have to recognize the fears, right?
Yes.
Because we're seeing that a lot nowadays, mm-hmm. particularly with the climate crisis, mm-hmm. is that you're getting camps of people who do not quite understand the science and what's going on. And there's a bit of a fear, right, that takes hold where we retrench, status quo, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want to change. What does this mean? And again, to be a true leader and an authentic leader, I think you have to paint a positive vision for that person, addressing those fears, and like you said, understanding their motivations to make it progress forward.
You've obviously dedicated yourself to this. Mm-hmm. Can you paint that positive vision, including addressing the fear that you're trying to put me out of business, you green people?
Absolutely. Let's think of a future where you have no air pollution from coal-fired plants. Mm-hmm. Your cars are electric, right? Mm-hmm. There are thousands of more acres of parkland and trees. You have clean water that you can fish out of and eat. There are millions of birds, songbirds, that we're losing annually. This environment is something that we should strive for. But on the business sense, when you are reducing the waste that you are throwing out, or you're reducing the fuel use, which is carbon dioxide and greenhouse mm-hmm. gases, then you're saving money. So if you live within a building that is much more energy efficient, it's less money to operate. We're also finding that as new technologies come in, new clean technologies, productivity is drastically increasing, right? So you're able to manufacture things much more efficiently. You can then use materials that are recycled, so it's called circular economy. Again, a benefit to a company that doesn't have to mine and get raw materials from another part of the world. There's a huge business case that can be made around implementing sustainability, tackling issues like climate change.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming there's a lot of work to be done to make this cost effective. And in other places, it's already been done.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there are a number of examples. Well, take a look at the cost of batteries. The cost of batteries has dropped over 80% in the last 3 years. Because the technology is continually improving. Solar panels. Even 10 years ago, we could not afford solar panels. There wasn't a business case. Now they're cheaper than coal, and particularly in the southern United States. And this is true right across the board with technologies, right? All technologies, if you think about it, follow an S-curve. And so those technologies, their costs are dropping rapidly as they get adopted, whether it's LED lights or electric vehicles or solar power, et cetera.
What are the common barriers in pushing the sustainability agenda?
One, as you mentioned, is in the past, when I started my career, sustainability was something that you did to feel good. People saw the environment as that do good. It's separate from business. What has changed drastically over the last 25 years is people are now understanding that, again, when you address environmental issues, you're saving money. A great example is if you're a transportation company and you spend millions of dollars of money on fuel, right, which creates greenhouse gases, causes climate change. If you can reduce that fuel use, then you save money. You increase your profitability. Plus, you make your community cleaner. Right? If you're switching to electric, you have much less maintenance costs, for example. If you have a hybrid vehicle, you're not replacing the brakes as much, and so on. And there are examples across all kinds of industries that are showing that sustainability is much more tied to good business than it is a feel good. Other aspects where it helps the business is it enhances your brand, right? Young people want to buy from companies mm-hmm. that have purpose and are generating more responsible products.
People like me want to buy from them, and I'm not so young anymore.
Right. Exactly. It helps you reduce risk. Climate change right now, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is causing flooding, greater extreme weather events, and so forth. And now the financial industry is seeing this as a business risk.
If you're in the insurance business, it's a big business, right?
Absolutely. And so they're asking companies to be transparent and mm-hmm. to indicate what is their strategy to reduce their risk due mm-hmm. to climate change. If you're tackling climate change, you now have a business incentive because the cost of capital will increase if you are not addressing your insurance, not get insurance for certain assets or certain types of business, properties along the coast, right? So again, you're always trying to either mitigate risk or advance an opportunity, mm-hmm. make more mm-hmm. money. That's how the business is making a decision. And what we've learned is sustainability, the principles of sustainability address both those factors.
And encouraging that we are now systemically moving to a place where mitigating risk is a big deal. I didn't realize that financing was now being tied.
Yeah. So good old Canadian Mark Carney, who used to be the bank governor of the Bank of Canada, has come out with a number of other prominent figures and backed by a huge number of financial institutions around the Task Force for Climate Disclosure. And what they're basically saying is you need to be prepared for climate change. Climate mm-hmm. change is mm-hmm. coming, and it's going to impact your business, and it's going to impact the economy. For investors to understand the risk of their investment or the opportunity mm-hmm. of their investment, you need to disclose what the material risk is of your business on the climate and the climate on your business.
Okay, so I get the climate on my business. If I'm an insurance company,
right.
Certainly my underwriters and my actuaries are looking at that. I didn't realize, and I think it's interesting, that it's going the other way around, that we're finding a way to eliminate the free rider issue.
Absolutely, because what's happening, is the institutions, the financial institutions, are now looking at the science and looking at their business returns. And they're saying, well, hold on a sec. If we continue to emit greenhouse gases, that is going to increase the impacts of climate change and thus drive down our returns on investment.
On every investment.
On every investment.
Okay.
Right? So what they're saying is, well, if you're a very high, intense, carbon-emitting industry, mm-hmm. you burn coal, then you're putting a greater risk on my investment, both in you and in my portfolio because of your actions. So I'm going to withdraw my investment from you because you're a higher risk.
To the whole portfolio.
Right, to the whole portfolio. Yeah, and you have a greater risk in disappearing or the value substantially mm-hmm. declining mm-hmm. because you're in an industry that is contributing to climate change, which is a economic, social, and environmental mm-hmm. crisis.
Just what's so fascinating is what I call the free rider. I think that's the term we use commonly, that if I'm the one who is causing that risk, as long as I can get capital and no one punishes me or extracts a cost, then I have no incentive to change.
Exactly.
It sounds like we are now moving to a place in time where that's changing.
It is changing, and I think it's still too slow, I would contend, compared to mm-hmm. what the scientists say. Mm-hmm. But it is moving because, one, the financial industry is starting to bring in these parameters upon which they're assessing their portfolio. And two is governments, which play mm-hmm. a critical role, mm-hmm. right, in sort of the preventing the tragedy of the commons, right? Mm-hmm. Anything that's an externality or outside the business, government is there to protect us. And they are now starting to institute policies such as in mm-hmm. Canada, carbon price on carbon pollution.
Have they gone to that now?
They have, yeah. Okay. So the federal government has mandated a national carbon price for those provinces. So in Canada, I think like the states, the jurisdiction to implement environmental regulations is with the provinces. Those provinces that don't have an equivalency to a carbon price, then the federal carbon price is applied. But if they have a carbon price, like the province of British Columbia has a carbon price, then the provincial standard stays in place.
Now, how does that work? Is it a tax, basically, if I emit over a certain amount? I incur a cost that's paid to
right.
the government?
On a very simplistic term is think of a price as like a sales tax. If you emit a ton of carbon that you should use, then you're going to pay a certain price on that ton of carbon. So if I'm a utility, if I go to the gas pump, then they're calculating how much you're emitting and then they're charging you a fee. Now, the Canadian government has done it quite wisely in the sense that they don't just take that money and put it into the general revenue. Mm-hmm. What they do is give back 80% of that to Canadians, of which lower income will get a greater percentage. If you're smart and a homeowner, if you take that money and invest it in energy efficiency, a more efficient car and that, you can get more money back than you would spend on the carbon tax, which is great. The remaining part, I think it's 20%, goes into investing in projects that will lower greenhouse gases, right? So it'll go into retrofitting schools, or helping with the various, I don't know if it does renewable energy, but projects that will help communities reduce their footprint.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it is. But it has been difficult, back to leadership, it has been difficult in the past, probably, I don't know now, 10, 15 years ago, we had a prime minister who came in and ran on a carbon price and lost very poorly, very badly. Because people saw it as a tax and climate change wasn't an issue. This federal election, which just happened in Canada a week ago, climate change was in the top three issues that were spoken about on the campaign trail. And our prime minister, the incumbent, ran again on putting a price on pollution. And this time, Canadians gave him a mandate, a minority, but still a mandate back saying they agree with it. So just in that decade, that's quite a shift.
Who is leading globally? Is Canada the leader in finding solutions?
Well, I would say that you, like any topic you pick, countries are leading in different areas. Canada has some very strong strengths in things like technologies to make resource sectors more productive, buildings more energy efficient.
So this is the lead platinum, lead silver.
Right, and because of our cold climate, we have some very good technologies that are working in buildings, battery technology, et cetera. And so you can go around the world and each country has strengths and weaknesses and areas. And of course, being a global economy, that's okay because you can get those technologies elsewhere.
So we can look at best in class, basically, and identify who's taking the lead in each category, basically, that I would care about. And learn from them.
Yeah, exactly. And those that leadership goes across, you know, several factors. It's policy leadership. It's economic stimulant around the clean technology, like helping to stimulate the clean technology sector, or technologies themselves. As I said to some students I talked to last week, is we're at this precipice of life, and we have a choice which path we go down. And this is where I think it is essential that people really dig deep. We're all leaders in our own, what I call, sphere of influence. And I think we need to step up and voice our concern, as we were talking, in a respectful and productive manner, but then start to really push on our political leaders and our corporate leaders that things need to change for our businesses, for our communities, for our children. And that means sometimes stepping out of your comfort zone. And I'll give you an example is, we had climate strikes here, of course, and I have never in my life, I think, marched on the street. But it is now time to get, because I like to work behind the scenes, but it's now time to get uncomfortable. And I needed to show my kids, my young staff, that I was going to be out there supporting them as well. So I wrote a letter to all my colleagues and CEOs in Ottawa expressing the need that they should allow their staff to go out in the climate march on company time. I sent a letter out to all staff in the organization that they could take that time off to participate. And then I reached out to the youth that were organizing it to say, how can I help? Whether that's a financial contribution or maybe more importantly, where I think we added the most value, some of us gray-haired folks around the table, was, you know, helping them understand when you organize that you need to prioritize your tasks. You need to get the message right so you're not ostracizing one group. You need to use the power of social media, which they do very well, but in a constructive and respectful way, rather than a, you know,
bashing.
You're bashing and you're dumb. So that's where I think leadership in each of us plays a key role. What can we do within our sphere of influence to have a positive impact? And that's what we all want, as we were talking about, right? That most of us, that radical middle, just want to have a job, have roof over our head, food, family, fun, and to leave this place a little better than it was, rather than worse.
One of the things that's been a theme for me over the period of the conference has been the idea that we have choice. So whether I am wealthy and have resources and run a company, it's easier for you and I to have choice. But we all have choices in what we buy, what we don't buy, whether we march. And I also realize there are people who are working 2 and 3 jobs and they can't take off work to march.
Exactly.
And they can't spend extra money on some things. So we have a little more choice.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, again, this is where, if you think of that sphere of influence, is because of my job and where I live in that, I have the ability to buy solar panels for my house and buy an electric car. But I certainly know that some of the younger people or some of the people in more challenging situations don't have that opportunity. So are there things that they can do that they feel comfortable in? So is it just participate in a march, right? Is it to
compost?
You know, compost, right? Whatever
renewable
works for them.
Water bottles instead of buying bottled water.
Exactly. Writing their MP about the need for change. So again, this is where it's important for us to work. Again, I'll use that term sphere of influence in what we believe is most important to us. So even if climate change is not your most important issue, but poverty reduction is, or disadvantaged youth, then I encourage people, then put your energy into that, because it's all, to me, that's leadership. That's helping someone else. For those of us that are privileged, I think it's really important that we open doors for others. And this is something that a young lady, Larissa, brought to my attention at one of our events, where she recognized that she was the only woman of color and of indigenous background in the entire 200-person event. And it was something that I sadly say I didn't even recognize. But what I did was I immediately engaged her and asked her to provide us with guidance and insight on how we could do better. And then I set targets within our event, our big, we do a biannual huge event in Vancouver every year called the Globe Forum, to set targets around gender. So 50-50 women speakers, indigenous participation, diversity, inclusion, and then work with other organizations to try to get more people who wouldn't normally get the opportunity to do that. So whatever, again, we can do, but we need to be able to open the door and help others that might not have those opportunities.
It does seem like as you go through that list, there's so much to think about.
There is.
And then I have to get my work done.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a great point. And again, I think it comes back to what are the little things that you can do, right? So if you have, I was there before with 2 young kids driving them around to hockey and, you know, you're racing to just try to
to get through the day.
To get through the day. So maybe that time you're not doing much, right? But you're keeping
educated. You're making good choices. You're educating your
Absolutely.
Children. I think we underestimate the value of educating our children, being a good role model. I mean, simple stuff like the water bottles, like the composting, that we just integrate into our daily experience.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And you're right. I mean, those conversations, especially with our kids and their friends and so forth, are incredibly powerful. So I couldn't agree more.
And modeling it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Not just talking about that we should do it, but I have a compost bin in my backyard. There are lots of decisions we make that seem minor. And I realize there occasionally I'll say, I could walk to the recycle or I could throw it in the trash, and it's a walk to the recycle. It is a conscious decision, and it's not always the easiest decision.
Yeah, and I think that also transfers to our language around our kids as well, right? So rather than referring to someone who doesn't understand the science of climate change as an idiot, or right?
Which many of us have done.
Right, which we've done in front of our kids, which then stokes this divisive language that's out there, is to educate.
Embrace and include
and listen and understand.
And I think the embracing and including people who see the world differently, for me, is hard to do.
Yeah, exactly. And that, again, to me, is a great lesson for leaders, again, being able to articulate and verbalize your vision in that is important. But listening, being empathetic and understanding and then learning from those differences are what make you a much better leader.
How do you train and teach leaders of tomorrow to courageously embrace sustainability in a better world?
In my life, I do a lot of guest lecturing. But when I say lecturing, it's interesting. I find the best ways is I give them a little background of who I am, and then we have a conversation, and I open it up and allow them to ask questions that they want to know about rather than me just simply telling them. So one, I think, is that constant engagement and conversation. Two is to provide them with opportunities. So, for example, we started a not-for-profit called Leading Change Canada. And this is where we bring young people, 19 to 35, together to talk about these issues, to network with others, to educate themselves, engage in the dialogues and that, and most importantly, empower them through mentorship and leadership training that will allow them to then take those lessons and skills back to hopefully advance the economy to a more sustainable one.
And to take the lead in those places where
Absolutely.
They land.
Exactly, yeah.
So what to you are the biggest barriers to seeing change happen, and what personal struggles have you had?
Some of the biggest barriers, I think, are one is a lack of curiosity and understanding of the science and what it truly means to the businesses or the people themselves, and being able to translate that in a way that connects with them. Two is the reality of our society and how we live and work is at a disconnect right now to what we need to do to actually tackle climate change. And you know, one thing that I'm a little embarrassed about is, you know, I will become a million-mile flyer this coming month or next month or whatever. And that just shows you someone who has studied climate change for 25 years, and yet I've learned that much. But it's a necessity on the one side of my business and personal life and passions, but on the other side, it's having a tremendous impact. And so that gets very frustrating for myself and probably others who are trying to make it different. The third is that how slow things have moved. You know, I've been in this, well, working on climate change since 1997 and on sustainability since 1992. And that's a long time. And things have moved a lot on one side and haven't moved much at all in another. We need to figure out how to really start to accelerate that change. And I think it's coming. I think it's coming because we're seeing the youth stand up and impart their democratic right and leadership in their own right. We're seeing the financial institutions starting to understand the risks to their business and thus, you know, assert pressure on companies that, hey, you need to look at this issue of climate change. the positive components of sustainability and seeing how this makes better business sense. This is not just about feeling good. This is about enhancing your brand, creating new products and services, retaining and attracting new employees, right, and saving money.
So all of those make sense from a business case, and yet we're seeing, to your point, much slower adoption. And I do wonder, now that we're seeing more climate volatility, you can't argue that we're having more storms. We keep having 100-year storms every month. That's probably an exaggeration, but we're having much more frequent, much more dramatic weather events. It's hard to deny that something's happening.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what we need to do now is take these shocks to the system and use them constructively, though, for conversation again,
mm-hmm.
because they can be very frightful things,
mm-hmm.
you know, the for people who are experiencing them. And we need to understand their pain in that, but then use it as part of a dialogue to say we need to make change quicker.
Is there anything in your personal life, in your own transition, that you would share? You mentioned the Million Miler piece. Anything else that you found difficult?
Well, I think having kids is an interesting journey in itself, both extremely positive and also extremely frustrating at times. It's been interesting to see and have conversations with them and seeing them have the same desires and I'll call them blocks or barriers, mm-hmm. obstacles to change. And so they still want to buy lots of clothes, fast fashion, big car and a fancy car as they get older, et cetera. Why I use that example is we just seem to be on the treadmill, right? Like
mm-hmm.
we're not getting off the treadmill into changing the way we live and the way we mm-hmm. live in life. I find that very frustrating at times.
I was having a conversation the other day. It was a lovely day, sitting on my porch with a client, and I realized there was a big storm out west, snow months earlier than normal. But sitting in my little spot, everything seemed just fine. So it's hard to remember when I want to go buy something fashionable or just take a trip that isn't required, that I'm burning fossil fuel, that I should consider the cost to the environment of each action I take.
Yeah.
Because when I look, it looks like the world's just fine.
Yeah, and I agree. And that makes it very difficult. But your words are a great example where we said, you know, the cost to the environment, but it's actually a cost to society and to our bank account, to be honest, right? Because we talked earlier about insurance and that. If we're not able to get insurance on our home, and then it, God forbid, it burns down or
mm-hmm.
something,
mm-hmm.
that's a tremendous impact. But you're right. And this short-sightedness is what makes these challenges like climate change so hard to grasp and to tackle, right? Is people are, you know, thousands of years and have built us a certain way. So we want to be part of a tribe. So if that tribe doesn't believe climate change, it's very hard to come outside that. The cognitive dissonance, if it moves mm-hmm. too much, we don't want to think about it, right? We
mm-hmm.
move on. Right? These types of things, I think, play a huge role, and that's why we have to understand humans more. Again, back to the way we engage one another is, this has to be about us, you know, as individuals and our communities and our tribes
mm-hmm.
and working and understanding that to find solutions to go forward. So,
I love your wording. It's not a cost to society, it's a cost to our children.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That changes what I think or what I hear as we have the conversation. And I think those are the shifts, and I appreciate your correction that even just changing the linguistics changes my thought process.
Absolutely. I would still contend that we made, and when I say we, you know, environmentalists or progressive people made a huge mistake when we framed climate change as an environmental issue.
Instead of a family issue or a
financial, right? A social mm-hmm. issue, because mm-hmm. that's what it is, right? When you see those hurricanes, my heart goes out to people in Bahamas and Texas and Florida and so on, right, that have been hit by these, New Brunswick, and is that this is a social issue. It's going to impact us all at some point. So as you said, right now you're seeing the beautiful lake and that and the storm on the distant horizon, but it will impact at some. But again, we don't want to create a fear that then people
withdraw
and oh, well, it's over. That comes back to the leadership and communicating that vision about a place where we have, clean air and we have good jobs and high tech, clean tech, you know, spaces, and there's parks and trees, and our families are living, you know, within the means of the planet, you know. And I think that's important to go to the positive, as we've talked about.
Most of us are motivated by a vision we can touch and see.
Right.
Right, that this is possible for me in my lifetime.
Yeah.
So you've been doing this for 25 years. Mm-hmm. What gives you the most hope?
I think the thing we've been talking about the most is humans. We are, and young people in particular that I engage, is that energy, right? That I can do anything comes out. And if you think about the challenges we've overcome, world wars and, plagues and all these things over the thousands of years, we've always come out of it
stronger,
right? But we've done that because we're a community and we come together and we recognize the differences and the value of those differences, and we work together. And that really gives me hope, especially in an amazing country like Canada that is so diverse and has so many great people, which the United States does as well, right? And if you go around the world now, this is what's bringing us together, I think, is diversity and difference of opinion and hope for a positive future.
Well, my hope is we have listeners around the world who are engaging in this conversation by listening and by making changes in their lives. It is a global issue.
It is.
We live on the same planet, and what we do in every country impacts the whole.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that with the weather events. It impacts the whole. So the invitation is certainly for people around the world to consider the impact each of us is having on all of us.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more.
So, Mike, thank you. How would people learn more? Do you have a website or a...
Absolutely. So you can find us in the Delphi Group at www.delphi.ca. And the Globe Series is globeseries.com. And Leading Change is leadingchangecanada.com.
And we will post that information as well with more of your resources. Can you give our listeners, as we wrap up, two concrete steps they can take to make change in wherever they are in their communities?
Wherever you are in your communities, one is to speak out. Let your political and corporate leaders know how you feel that change is needed. And two is find that area of passion that you feel emboldens you to take action and really put your efforts there, whether it's climate change or, like I said, poverty reduction or composting.
I love what you said earlier about listening. Smart people run the gamut. If we think of the bell-shaped curve, most of us are in some sphere of the middle.
Yeah.
And we can reach out and have intelligent conversation and influence one another and take collective action.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is a wonderful message to leave with people, is when you're having that argument with someone you disagree with, just maybe take a deep breath for a second and listen and try to see if you can learn something which will improve you, and then share something back which will improve them and your connection to one another.
Thank you. What each of us does matters. And it matters for all of us.
It does.
And we want to leave our children and grandchildren with a planet that they can inhabit without wearing masks.
Agree. Thank you.
Mike, thank you so much for all of the work you do to make our world better.
Great. Thank you for having me.